Okay, so we're on page 103. We're going to start the urinary system up there with four major functions of the urinary system, or five rather. So the first major job is something we've talked about before. We remove waste products through the urinary system. I know in lab you guys are talking about acid-base balance. So one thing we can do is excrete into the urine waste products from metabolism, such as hydrogen ions, or even, you know, other things like urea and uric acid. So we're going to talk about some of that as we go through this chapter. We also know that the urinary system helps to regulate blood composition and blood volume. So let's go way back to the endocrine system at this point. Can you tell me two hormones that contribute to blood volume? Good. ADH and aldosterone. Both do, of course, regulate blood volume and blood, how much water we've got in that blood plasma. Number three is a big one. The urinary system is our second controlling system that helps to regulate blood pH. What is the other controlling system? Respiratory, yes. So we just got through with hyper and hypoventilation as compensations for acid-base problems. Now we're going to turn our focus to understanding how the kidneys can compensate for respiratory issues. And of course, we've talked about blood pressure. We know that ADH and aldosterone are controlling that blood pressure. We're going to go back through that renin-angiotensin mechanism. And then something, one little fact not to forget here, EPO is also produced by the kidneys. What is the stimulus for EPO production?
Low oxygen.
Good, good. And of course, what does EPO target? Bone marrow. Yep, bone marrow. And of course, you're right, turn on red blood cell production. This is a pretty simple system. There are two kidneys, two ureters, one urinary bladder, and one urethra. You'll notice in this picture the right and left kidneys don't sit equal. This right kidney actually sits a little bit lower than the left kidney. What's pushing it out of the way? What's on the right side?
The
liver. Yeah, liver's on the right side. So
pushing it.
You've had to test your brain's got this right. So there's no bone, no muscle holding those kidneys in place. What we have instead are layers of connective tissue, fascia, and fat that hold them into place, and that's really it. That's why it's dangerous to be hit along the lower portion of your ribs where your kidneys are located. They can basically slide loose from their little connective tissue wrappings and then slide down the back part of your body wall. The problem with that is the ureters that lead away can kink up. It's like taking a drinking straw and just bending it in half. The urine can't flow out as easily if they're kinked up. So, you know, prolapsed or, you know, kidneys that have slid down are going to be a problem for the exit of that urine. So on your sheet there, you notice there are three layers of tissue surrounding the kidney, a fibrous capsule, another fat capsule, and then fascia that holds all that in place. The medial indentation is called the what? Hilus, good. What comes and goes from the kidney at that hilus?
Renal artery.
Renal artery, renal vein, and one more thing? Ureters, good. Okay, and of course, sitting on top of each kidney is a gland called? Adrenal, good. Okay, so let's cut open a kidney and look on the inside. There are three regions, the renal cortex, renal medulla, and renal pelvis. This is their order from superficial to deep. So if you think about the kidney like a piece of fruit, when you peel away the outer peel, this portion here, you're left with an outer region underneath that's called the renal cortex. That renal cortex also forms renal columns. Those columns are situated between what? Yeah, between the pyramids. There they are. So this renal column tissue is, in fact, renal cortex. So even though it looks like it might be in that medulla region, it, in fact, includes renal cortex tissue. The next layer, as we're coming deeper toward the center of the kidney, is called the renal medulla or medulla. And what are we looking for in that area?
The pyramids.
The pyramids, good. So if you're in one of these pyramids, you're in that renal medulla region. And of course, keep in mind the column separating those pyramids is cortex tissue. The deepest region of your kidney is called the renal what?
Pelvis.
Pelvis, good. So this basin-like area where urine collects is called the pelvis. Urine collects here, and then it travels down the ureters, where it's then stored and housed in the urinary bladder. So let's talk about the calyces. Calyces are little grooves inside your kidney. So each one of these renal pyramids has a tip called a renal papilla. Each papilla will drip with urine into a minor calyx first. So the minor calyx is a groove right around the edges of that renal papilla. From there, the urine drips into a region that we call the major calyx. So if you follow one of the minors out where you've got two of these grooves joining, then we're now into a region that we call the major calyx. I keep it straight like baseball. You play for the minor leagues, then you play for the major leagues, and then you go down into the renal pelvis and then down to the ureter. Well, you've actually got part of a tracing so far. At the very bottom of your page, you'll notice that we travel with urine from the renal pyramid to the renal papilla, minor calyx, major calyx, renal pelvis. Here we are in the ureter. What's next?
Urinary bladder.
Urinary bladder. And what's last?
Urethra.
Urethra. Yep. So that's actually part of one of our tracings. When we talk about excreting items into the urine or secreting them into the urine, that is the portion of the pathway that we're going to have to use. Okay. Any questions there on page 103? On page 104, we're going to now target in on the functional unit of the kidney. The functional and structural unit is called the nephron. That's a good test question. The functional, and you guys don't have much time to be studying this time, right? The functional and structural unit of the kidney is the nephron. It's a good thing to highlight. You have this, it's about a 4-inch tall kidney model in lab. You probably saw the little squiggly white lines. It looks like somebody's been doodling. And of course, those are nephrons. There's about 1 million in each one of your kidneys. People who have one kidney removed can still function with the remaining kidney. Their body actually enlarges the kidney, so you can still filter all the blood. So you can live, of course, with one functional kidney as long as it's doing the filtration process. This is a nephron. It's laid out flat. In real life, nephrons don't lay flat like a piece of paper. If this was a piece of paper, I would take it and let it give itself a hug. So I would coil it up like I was making a tube from my piece of paper. What that means is this tail end down here would be giving a hug to the front end over here. So in reality, it sits kind of like a little circular structure inside your kidney. I make that point because we're going to look at something a little more complicated like this, and you're going to see there's the tail end right there butting up against this structure. So let's talk about the parts of a nephron, starting with the renal corpuscle. Okay, so funky old word here. Renal corpuscle is a region of your nephron that includes glomerulus, which is a set of capillaries. They are sometimes called the glomerular capillaries. Those capillaries are surrounded by a capsule. The old name is called the Bowman's capsule. They're trying to get away from naming stuff after people. They're trying to get more to a more descriptive term, so that's why they have in parentheses glomerular capsule. All right, tell me what you know about capillaries. Exchanges take place. Good. Tell me about their structure. Small, simple, yeah, epithelial, good. Very thin walls, great for exchange. So the glomerular capillaries are no exception. They are very small, they're thin-walled, they are simple squamous, and they're great for pushing fluids out of your bloodstream. The rest of your tube is made up of a tubule system, and that's going to be your proximal convoluted tubule, or PCT for short. The loop of Henle, which is more currently called the nephron loop, and a distal convoluted tubule we call DCT for short. Way, way back in Bio 210, you probably learned about proximal and distal. Which one of those terms means close?
Proximal.
Proximal, good. And of course, distal's far. So we're close and far from the glomerulus. okay, part of that renal corpuscle. That's our relationship there. So when we're thinking about PCT and DCT, the relationship is back with that renal corpuscle. Let's go back and look at this picture. You've got one in your course pack that's tiny. If you would like to label one, there is one over page 111. So glomerulus means a set of capillaries, and these capillaries are thin, they're porous, they're great for pushing fluids out. They are surrounded by a capsule that's called our glomerular or Bowman's capsule. Okay. You'll notice a set of tubes that emerge away from that glomerular capsule. The first set of curvy tubes are called our proximal convoluted tubule. You guys are absolutely welcome to use PCT on the test. If you do the tracings, then just use PCT and save your hand the cramp of having to write out proximal convoluted tubule. All right, so what comes next in terms of our flow path?
DCT.
Loop of Henle, good. And the alternate name, of course, is nephron loop. You probably know from lab there is a descending limb for that nephron loop, and there's an ascending limb. So as we come from the PCT, we travel down the descending limb first, and then up the ascending limb of that nephron loop. Now we're getting farther away from the renal corpuscle, so we consider this next curvy tube a DCT. So this is the distal convoluted tubule. And these DCTs are going to dump into one of our collecting ducts, and you can call it a collecting duct or a collecting tube. So that collecting duct is like a big pipe. And on the picture, on your course pack, it looks like there's little stumps there. Those little stumps are actually other DCTs dumping into your collecting tube. So imagine it's like a big pipe running down a street. A lot of businesses are going to dump their waste into that pipe. Same thing with a collecting duct. There's lots of DCTs coming from other nephrons that utilize that same collecting duct to dump waste. I want to kind of give you perspective for what we're dealing with here. A lot of these renal pyramids on the models look like they have a striped appearance, and you may have noticed that in lab. And those lines running through the renal pyramid are, in fact, these collecting ducts. They're going to be pointing toward that renal papilla. And what drips from the renal papilla?
Urine.
Urine, yeah. And sitting right around is a tiny groove that we call what? Yeah, there's one minor calyx on this side, another on this side. The urine drips from the renal papilla into the minor calyx first. And I'm out of room here, but the next one would be your major calyx. What's next? Renal pelvis. What comes next? Ureter. Then? And you got it. Okay. You with me so far? I know after test day it's awful to have new material. Okay. So if you pretend that your nephron on page 111 rolls around and gives itself a hug, you can actually see that your DCT kind of butts up against your glomerulus. You know, if you think about it sitting in a tube like this. So I'm going to show you another picture of how this works so that we can talk about the renin-angiotensin mechanism. And that, by the way, is one of those guaranteed essay questions. So about halfway down your page, look for the term juxtaglomerular apparatus. I know what. That's 104, juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, do you know what you're looking at here? That actually is glomerulus there, okay? And what is surrounding the glomerulus?
The
capsule, good. And if you follow it away, over here is your PCT, okay? And so we don't see the rest of that tubule, but wrapping on this side, notice, is the DCT. So like I mentioned, if you let your nephron give itself a hug, the DCT wraps right up and butts up against your glomerulus. I want to tell you something about these blood vessels here. We know the glomerulus is a set of capillaries. What type of vessel brings blood into a set of capillaries? Arterioles, good. What normally drains the capillary bed? A venule. Okay, so this is a little wacky. Look at this. We've got an arteriole coming in with blood. This one is called the afferent arteriole. And here we are leaving with another arteriole. This one's called the efferent arteriole. So in fact, we don't have a venule that's draining the capillary bed. That's not what we expected to see. But the setup of having two arterioles here will actually maintain high pressure in your capillary bed. Any reason we should have high pressure in our capillaries? What are we trying to get rid of? Yeah, which is waste stuff, right? So if you want to push stuff out that doesn't come back on you, you've got to have high enough pressure to push it, causing filtration. And what are we trying to prevent from happening? Backflow, yeah, that reabsorption process. So wouldn't it be kind of pointless if we made urine and then turned around and reabsorbed the urine? So what we're doing is we're actually having high pressure to push out that blood plasma, and then don't let it get reabsorbed, at least not yet. So to make sure that we have a high enough push or pressure behind the blood traveling through those glomerular capillaries, we have a detection device sitting right here. And this little detection device is called the glomerular apparatus. It is sitting between your afferent arteriole, your efferent arteriole, and this distal convoluted tubule. It is a triangular region of cells, and it's called the JGA for short. So juxtaglomerular apparatus is called the JGA for short, and it detects pressure of the blood coming through your glomerulus. Okay, so it's detecting blood pressure. Here's your essay. So I encourage you to put this in your own words where it makes sense for you. Get out of the way.
Oh, wow.
It's like in a Disney World, you know. Okay, so that JGA picks up on blood pressure problems. Keep in mind the whole goal here is to make sure that blood pressure is high enough to maintain filtration. So notice the stimulus. The stimulus is low blood pressure. All right, so what chemical is released by your JGA if pressure is too low?
Renin.
Okay, I just want to make a point here. There's one N for this renin. That's not the same thing as the renin with two N's that was in your stomach, right? Totally different renin there. But this renin with one N is released from your JGA. It goes to your liver, okay? And in your liver, we turn on production of a chemical called angiotensin 1. Okay, so one converts to two using an enzyme called ACE. Yeah, angiotensin converting enzyme. Two is more powerful than one. That makes sense, right? Okay, so two, angiotensin 2 is a really potent vasoconstrictor. Let me go back a picture for just a moment. If you want to keep blood in the glomerulus and force it to be filtered, Should you squeeze the incoming flow or squeeze the outgoing flow? You don't want it to escape. Outgoing, yeah. If you squeeze the incoming flow, the blood never gets here, right? But if you squeeze the outgoing flow, the blood can't get out. So where is it stuck? Doing what? Filtering. Yeah, let it get filtered. So back it up, let it sit in the glomerulus, force it to be filtered, because what we're going to do is remove waste products that contribute to urine formation. So that angiotensin II, by being a vasoconstrictor, it not only can squeeze that efferent flow pathway, it can also squeeze other vessels in your body. What happens to blood pressure when you squeeze a vessel? Increases, right. So this is a way for us to maintain filtration, even if you have low blood pressure. So if you have become dehydrated because it's a hot day, if you haven't had enough to eat or drink, then this mechanism kicks on to make sure that you still remove the waste products into your urine. What happens if you don't filter? You keep all that, right? You retain it. So all those toxins that should be going into the urine are floating in your bloodstream. So that's why keeping this mechanism available if we need it is a great thing in case you have low blood pressure. Notice the last step here is angiotensin II activates the release of aldosterone. Where's aldosterone made? Adrenal cortex. And ADH made by the
hypothalamus.
We are so gone on Monday. I'm going to make a note that we're going to start here on Monday. We'll review this whole process and we'll finish this chapter on Monday. All right, y'all have a good weekend. Oh, yeah.